her black robe. Death everlasting is the realm of the Lady Most Kind. It is a mystery not intended for penetration or comprehension from our side of the Lady's Shroud. Death, the transition, therefore, is the sole means by which we may achieve a greater understanding of her dark majesty. Your time here in Revelation House will bring you close to Death the Transition on many occasions, and it is a certainty that some of you will pass beyond before you finish your initiation. This may be achieved through inattentiveness, lassitude, ill fortune, or the inscrutable will of the Lady Most Kind herself. As initiates of the Lady, you will be exposed to Death the Transition and its consequences for the rest of your lives. You must grow accustomed to it. It is natural for living flesh to recoil from the presence of death and from thoughts of death. Your discipline must overcome what is natural. 2. As with most Therin temples, initiates of the first inner mystery were mostly expected to train their scribing, sums, and rhetoric to the point that they could enter higher levels of study without distracting more advanced initiates. Jean, with his advantages in age and training, was inducted into the second inner mystery a bare month and a half after arrival. "Henceforth," said the priest conducting the ceremony, "you will conceal your faces. You will have no features of boy or girl, man or woman. The priesthood of the Lady Most Kind has only one face, and that face is inscrutable. We must not be seen as individuals, as fellow men and women. The office of the Death Goddess servants must disquiet if those we minister to are to compose their thoughts to her properly." The sorrowful visage was the silver mask of the Order of Azaguia. For initiates, it bore a crude resemblance to a human face, with a rough indentation for the nose and holes for the eyes and mouth. For full priests, it was a slightly ovoid hemisphere of fine silver mesh. Jean donned his sorrowful visage, eager to get to work cataloguing more secrets of the Order, only to discover that his duties were little changed from his month as an initiate of the first inner mystery. He still carried messages and scribed scrolls, swept floors and scoured the kitchens, still scurried up and down the precarious rock ladders beneath the bells of the 12, with the unfriendly sea crashing far below and the wind tugging at his robes. Only now he had the honour of doing all these things in his silver mask, with his peripheral vision partly blocked. Two more initiates of the second inner mystery fell to a first-hand acquaintance with Death the Transition shortly after Jean's elevation. About a month after that, Jean was poisoned for the first time. 3.
"Closer and closer," said the priestess, whose voice seemed muffled and distant. "Closer and closer to death the transition, to the very edge of the mystery. Feel your limbs growing cold. Feel your thoughts slowing. Feel the beating of your heart growing sluggish. The warm humours are banking down. The fire of life is fading."
She had given them some sort of green wine, a poison that Jean could not identify. Each of the dozen initiates of the second inner mystery in his morning class lay prostrated and twitching feebly, their silver masks staring fixedly upward as they could no longer move their necks. Their instructor hadn't quite managed to explain what the wine would do before she ordered them to drink it. Jean suspected that the willingness of the initiates around him to dance gaily on the edge of death the transition was still more theory than actuality. "Of course, look who knows so much better," he thought to himself, as he marvelled at how tingly and distant his legs had become. "Crooked warden, this priesthood is crazy. Give me strength to live, and I'll return to the gentleman bastards, where life makes sense." Yes, where he lived in a secret elderglass cellar beneath a rotting temple, pretending to be a priest of Perelandro,
while taking weapons lessons from the Duke's personal swordmaster. Perhaps a bit drunk on whatever drug was having its way with him, Jean giggled. The sound seemed to echo and reverberate in the low-ceilinged study hall. The priestess turned slowly. The sorrowful visage concealed her true expression, but in his drug-hazed mind Jean was certain he could feel her burning stare.
"An insight, Tavrin?"
He couldn't help himself. He giggled again. The poison seemed to be making merry with the tight-lipped inhibition he'd feigned since arriving at the temple.
"I saw my parents burned to death," he said. "I saw my cats burned to death. Do you know the noise a cat makes when it burns?"
Another damn giggle. He almost choked on his own spit in surprise.
"I watched and could do nothing. Do you know where to stab a man? To bring death now, or death in a minute, or death in an hour? I do."
He would have been rolling with laughter if he could move his limbs. As it was, he shuddered and twitched his fingers.
"Lingering death? 2 or 3 days of pain? I can give that too. Ah! Death the transition? We're old friends."
The priestess mask fixed directly on him. She stared for several drug-lengthened moments while Jean thought, "Oh, gods damn this stuff, I've already done it now."
"Tavrin," said the priestess, "when the effects of the emerald wine have passed, remain here. The High Proctor will speak to you then."
Jean lay in mingled bemusement and dread for the rest of the morning. The giggles still came, interspersed with bouts of drunken self-loathing. So much for a full session of work. Some false facer I turned out to be. That night, much to his surprise, he was confirmed as having passed into the third inner mystery of Azaguia.
"I knew we could expect exceptional things from you, Callus," said the High Proctor, a bent old man whose voice wheezed behind his sorrowful visage. "First, the extraordinary diligence you showed in your mundane studies, and your rapid mastery of the exterior rituals. Now, a vision during your very first anguishment. You are marked, marked, an orphan who witnessed the death of his mother and father. You were fated to serve the Lady Most Kind."
"What are the additional duties of an initiate of the third inner mystery?"
"Why, anguishment," said the High Proctor. "A month of anguishment, a month of exploration into death the transition. You shall take the emerald wine once again, and then you shall experience other means of closeness to the precipitous moment of the lady's embrace. You shall hang from silk until nearly dead. You shall be exsanguinated. You shall take up serpents, and you shall swim in the night ocean, wherein dwell many servants of the lady. I envy you, little brother. I envy you, newly born to our mysteries."
Jean fled Revelation House that very night. He packed his meager bag of belongings and raided the kitchens for food. Before entering Revelation House, he'd buried a small bag of coins beneath a certain landmark about a mile inland from the cliffs near the village of Sorrow's Ease, which supplied the cliffside temple's material wants. That money should suffice to get him back to Camor. He scrawled a note and left it on his sleeping pallet in the fresh new solitary chamber accorded to him for his advanced rank. Grateful for opportunities, but could not wait, have elected to seek the state of death everlasting, cannot be content with the lesser mysteries of death the transition. The lady calls. Tavrin Callus. He climbed the stone stairs for the last time, as the waves crashed in the darkness below. The soft red glow of alchemical storm lamps guided him to the top of Revelation House, and thence to the top of the cliffs, where he vanished unseen into the night. 4.
"Damn!"
said Galdo, when Jean had finished his tale. "I'm glad I got sent to the Order of Sendivani." The night of Jean's return, after Father Chains had grilled Jean in depth on his experiences at Revelation House, he'd let the four boys head up to the roof with clay mugs of warm Camori ale. They set out beneath the stars and the scattered silver clouds, sipping their ale with much exaggerated casualness. They savored the illusion that they were men, gathered of their own accord, with the hours of the night theirs to spend entirely at their own whim.
"No shit," said Carlo. "In the Order of Gandolo, we got pastries and ale every second week, and a copper piece every idler's day to spend as we wished. You know, for the Lord of Coin and Commerce."
"I'm particularly fond of our priesthood of the benefactor," said Locke, "since our main duties seem to be sitting around and pretending that the benefactor doesn't exist, when we're not stealing things, that is."
"Too right," said Galdo. "Death priesting is for morons."
"But still," asked Carlo, "didn't you wonder if they might not be right?"
He sipped his ale before continuing.
"That you might really be fated to serve the Lady Most Kind?"
"I had a long time to think about it on the way back to Camor," said Jean, "and I think they were right, just maybe not the way they thought."
"How do you mean?"
The Sansa spoke in unison, as they often did when true curiosity seized the pair of them at once. In reply, Jean reached behind his back, and from out of his tunic he drew a single hatchet, a gift from Don Maranzala. It was plain and unadorned, but well maintained and ideally balanced for someone who'd not yet come into his full growth. Jean set it on the stones of the temple roof and smiled.
"Oh,"
said Carlo and Galdo. Part 4. Desperate Improvisation. "I pitch like my hair's on fire." Mitch Williams. Chapter 12. The Fat Priest from Tal Verar. 1. When Locke awoke, he was lying on his back and looking up at a fading, grime-covered mural painted on a plaster ceiling. The mural depicted carefree men and women in the robes of the Therin Throne era, gathered around a cask of wine, with cups in their hands and smiles on their rosy faces. Locke groaned and closed his eyes again.
"And here he is," said an unfamiliar voice. "Just as I said, it was the poultice that answered for him. Most uncommonly good physic for the innervation of the bodily channels."
"Who the hell might you be?"
Locke found himself in a profoundly undiplomatic temper. "And where am I?" "You're safe, though I wouldn't go so far as to say comfortable." Jean Tannen rested a hand on Locke's left shoulder and smiled down at him. Usually rather fastidious, he was now several days unshaven, and his face was streaked with dirt. "And some former patients of the renowned Master Ibelius might also take issue with my pronouncement of safety." Jean made a quick pair of hand gestures to Locke. "We're safe. Speak freely."
"Tut, Jean, your little cut's a fine repayment for the work of the past few days."
The unfamiliar voice, it seemed, came from a wrinkled, bird-like man with skin like a weathered brown tabletop. His nervous dark eyes peeped out from behind thick optics, thicker than any Locke had ever seen. He wore a disreputable cotton tunic, spattered with what might have been dried sauces or dried blood, under a mustard-yellow waist jacket in a style 20 years out of date. His spring coils of curly grey hair seemed to sprout straight out from the back of his head, where they were pulled into a queue.
"I have navigated your friend back to the shores of consciousness."
"Oh, for Perelandro's sake, Ibelius. He didn't have a crossbow quarrel in his brain. He just needed to rest."
"His warm humours were at a singularly low ebb. The channels of his frame were entirely evacuated of vim. He was pale, unresponsive, bruised, desiccated, and malnourished."
"Ibelius?"
Locke attempted to sit up and was partially successful. Jean caught him by the back of his shoulders and helped him the rest of the way. The room spun.
"Ibelius, the dog-leech from the Redwater District?"
Dog leeches were the medical counterparts of the black alchemists. Without credentials or a place in the formal guilds of physicians, they treated the injuries and maladies of the right people of Camor. A genuine physicker might look askance at treating a patient for an axe wound at 2:30 the second hour of the morning and summon the city watch. A dog leech would ask no questions, provided his fee was paid in advance. The trouble with dog leeches, of course, was that one took one's chances with their abilities and credentials. Some really were trained healers, fallen on hard times or banished from the profession for crimes such as grave robbing. Others were merely improvisers, applying years' worth of practical knowledge acquired tending to the results of bar fights and muggings. A few were entirely mad, or homicidal, or, charmingly, both.
"My colleagues are dog leeches," sniffed Ibelius. "I am a physicker, collegium trained. Your own recovery is a testament to that."
Locke glanced around the room. He was lying, wearing nothing but a breech clout, on a pallet in a corner of what must have been an abandoned ashfall villa. A canvas curtain hung over the room's only door. Two orange-white alchemical lanterns filled the space with light. Locke's throat was dry, his body still ached, and he smelled rather unpleasant. Not all of it was the natural odor of an unwashed man. A strange, translucent residue flaked off his stomach and sternum. He poked at it with his fingers.
"What," said Locke, "is this crap on my chest?" "The poultice, sir. Varagnelli's poultice, to be precise, though I hardly presume your familiarity with the subject. I employed it to concentrate the waning energy of your bodily channels, to confine the motion of your warm humours in the region where it would do you the most good, to wit, your abdomen. We did not want your energy to dissipate."
"What was in it?"
"The poultice is a proprietary conglomeration, but the essence of its function is provided by the admixture of the gardener's assistant and turpentine."
"Gardener's assistant?"
"Earthworms," said Jean. "He means earthworms ground in turpentine."
"And you let him smear it all over me?"
Locke groaned and sank back down onto the pallet.
"Only your abdomen, sir, your much-abused abdomen."
"He's the physicker," said Jean. "I'm only good at breaking people. I don't put them back together."
"What happened to me, anyway?"
"Innovation, absolute innovation, as thorough as I've ever seen it."
Ibelius lifted Locke's left wrist while he spoke and felt for a pulse.
"Jean told me that you took an emetic the evening of Duke's Day."
"Did I ever?"
"And that you ate and drank nothing afterward. That you were then seized and severely beaten and nearly slain by immersion in a cask of horse urine. How fantastically vile, sir, you have my sympathies. And that you had received a deep wound to your left forearm. A wound that is now scabbing over nicely, no thanks to your ordeals, and that you remained active all evening despite your injuries and your exhaustion, and that you pursued your course with the utmost dispatch, taking no rest."
"Sounds vaguely familiar."
"You simply collapsed, sir. In layman's terms, your body revoked its permission for you to continue heaping abuse upon it."
Ibelius chuckled. "How long have I been here?"
2 days and 2 nights," said Jean.
"What? God's damn me! Out cold the whole time?"
"Quite," said Jean. "I watched you fall over. I wasn't 30 yards away, crouched in hiding. Took me a few minutes to realize why the bearded old beggar looked familiar."
"I have kept you somewhat sedated," said Ibelius, "for your own good."
"God's damn it!"
"Clearly my judgment was sound, as you would have had no will to rest otherwise, and it made it easier to use a series of fairly unpleasant poultices to greatly reduce the swelling and bruising of your face. Had you been awake, you surely would have complained of the smell."
"Ugh," said Locke. "Tell me you have something at hand I can drink at least."
Jean passed him a skin of red wine.
It was warm and sour and watered to the point that it was more pink than red, but Locke drank half of it down in a rapid series of undignified gulps.
"Have a care, Master Lamora, have a care," said Ibelius. "I fear you have little conception of your own natural limitations. Make him take the soup, Jean. He needs to regain his animal strength, or his humours will fade again. He is far too thin for his own good. He is fast approaching anemia."
Locke devoured the proffered cup, boiled shark in a milk and potato stew, bland, congealed, many hours past freshness, and positively the most splendid thing he could recall ever having tasted, and then stretched.
2 days, gods! I don't suppose we've been lucky enough to have Caparaza fall down some stairs and break his neck.
Hardly, said Jean. He's still with us, him and his bondsmage. They've been very busy, those two. It might interest you to know that the gentleman bastards are formally outcast, and I'm presumed alive, worth 500 crowns to the man that brings me in, preferably after I stop breathing.
Said Locke. Dare I ask, Master Rebellious, what keeps you here smearing earthworms on my behalf when either of us is your key to Caparaza's monetary favour?
I can explain that, said Jean.
Seems there was another Ibelius, who worked for Barsavi as one of his floating grave guards. A loyal Barsavi man, I should say.
Oh, said Locke. My condolences, Master Ibelius. A brother?
My younger brother. The poor idiot. I kept telling him to find another line of work. It seems we have a great deal of common sorrow, courtesy of Caparaza.
Yes, said Locke. Yes, Master Rebellious. I'm going to put that fucker in the dirt as deeply as any man who's ever been murdered, ever since the world began.
Ah, said Rebellious. So Jean says, and that's why I'm not even charging for my services. I cannot say I think highly of your chances, but any enemy of Caparaza is most welcome to my care and to my discretion.
Too kind, said Locke. I suppose if I must have earthworms and turpentine smeared on my chest, I'm very happy to have you, overseeing the affair.
Your servant, sir, said Ibelius.
Well, Jean, said Locke, we seem to have a hiding place, a physica, and the two of us. What are our other assets?
10 crowns, 15 solons, 5 coppers, said Jean. That cot you're lying on. You ate the wine and drank the soup. I've got the wicked sisters, of course. A few cloaks, some boots, your clothes, and all the rotting plaster and broken masonry a man could dream of.
And that's it?
Yes, except for one small thing.
Jean held up the silver mesh mask of a priest of Azaguia, the aid and comfort of the Lady of the Long Silence.
How the hell did you arrange that?
Right after I dropped you off at the edge of the cauldron, said Jean, I decided to row back to the temple district and make myself useful.
2. The fire within the house of Perelandro had yet to finish burning when Jean Tannen threw himself down, half-dressed, at the service entrance to the house of Azaguia, 2 squares northeast of the temple the gentleman bastards had called their home. Elderglass and stone could not burn, of course, but the contents of the house of Perelandro were another matter. With the elderglass reflecting and concentrating the heat of the flames, everything within the burrow would be scorched to white ash, and the rising heat would certainly do for the contents of the actual temple. A bucket brigade of yellow jackets milled around the upper temple, with little to do but wait for the heat and the hideous death-scented smoke to cease boiling out from the doors. Jean banged a fist on the latched wooden door behind the Death Goddess temple and prayed for the crooked warden's aid in maintaining the Ferrari accent he had too rarely practiced in recent months. He knelt down to make himself seem more pathetic. After a few minutes, there was a click, and the door slid open a fraction of an inch. An initiate, in unadorned black robes and a simple silver mask so familiar to Jean, stared down at him.
"My name is Tavrin Callas," said Jean.
I require your aid.
Are you dying? Asked the initiate. We can do little for those still in good health. If you require food and succor, I would suggest the house of Perelandro, although there seem to be difficulties this evening.
I am not dying, and I do require food and succor. I am a bound servant of the Lady Most Kind, an initiate of the Fifth Inner Mystery.
Jean had judged this lie carefully. The fourth rank of the Order of Azaguia was full priesthood. The fifth would be a realistic level for someone assigned to courier important business from city to city. Any higher rank, and he would be forced to deal with senior priests and priestesses who should have heard of him.
I was dispatched from Tal Verar to Jerish on the business of our order, but along the way my ship was taken by Jeremite raiders. They took my robes, my seals of office, my papers, and my sorrowful visage.
What?
The initiate, a girl, bent down to help Jean up. She was a quarter of his weight, and the effort was slightly comical.
They dared interfere with an envoy of the lady?
The Jeremites do not keep the faith of the 12, little sister, said Jean, who allowed himself to be dragged up to his knees. They delight in tormenting the pious. I was chained to an oar for many long days. Last night the galley that captured me weighed anchor in Camor Bay. I was assigned to dumping chamber pots over the side while the officers went ashore to debauch themselves. I saw the fins of our dark brothers in the water. I prayed to the lady and seized my opportunity.
One thing the brothers and sisters of Azaguia rarely advertised to outsiders, especially in Camor, was their belief that sharks were beloved of the goddess of death, and that their mysterious comings and goings and their sudden brutal attacks were a perfect encapsulation of the nature of the Lady Most Kind. Sharks were powerful omens to the silver-masked priesthood. The High Proctor of Revelation House had not been joking with his suggestion that Jean feel free to swim in the ocean after dark. Only the faithless, it was said, would be attacked in the waters beneath Revelation House.
The Dark Brothers, said the initiate with rising excitement. And did they aid you in your escape?
You mustn't think of it as aid, said Jean, for the lady does not aid, she allows. And so it is with the Dark Brothers. I dove into the water and felt their presence around me. I felt them swimming beneath my feet, and I saw their fins cutting the surface of the water. My captors screamed that I was mad. When they saw the brothers, they assumed that I was soon to be devoured, and they laughed. I laughed, too, when I crawled up onto the shore unharmed.
Praise the Lady, brother.
I do. I have and I shall, said Jean. She has delivered me from our enemies. She has given me a second chance to fulfill my mission. I pray, take me to the steward of your temple. Let me meet with your father or mother divine. I need only a visage and robes and a room for several nights while I put my affairs in order.
3. Wasn't that the name you apprenticed under, said Locke, all those years ago?
It was indeed.
Well, why don't they send messages? Won't they make inquiries and find out that Tavrin Callus was moved by divine curiosity to fling himself off a cliff?
Of course they will, said Jean, but it'll take weeks to send one and get a reply, and I don't mean to keep the disguise for quite that long. Besides, it'll be a bit of fun for them. When they eventually discover Callus is supposed to be dead, they can proclaim all sorts of visions and miracles, a manifestation from beyond the Shadelands, as it were.
A manifestation straight from the arse of a magnificent liar, said Locke. Well done, Jean.
I suppose I just know how to talk to death priests. We all have our little gifts.
I say, interrupted Abelius, is this wise? This flaunting of the robes of office of the priests of the Death Goddess herself? Tweaking the nose of the Lady Most Kind?
Ibelius touched his eyes with both hands, then his lips, and then entwined his fingers over his heart.
If the Lady Most Kind wishes to take offence, said Jean, she has had ample opportunity to crush me flatter than gold leaf for my presumptions.
Furthermore, said Locke. "Jean and I are sworn into the divine service of the benefactor, father of necessary pretexts. Do you hold with the crooked warden, Master Rebellious?"
"It never hurts to have a care in my experience. Perhaps I do not light hearth candles or give coin, but I do not speak unkindly of the benefactor."
"Well," said Locke, "our mentor once told us that the initiates of the benefactor are strangely immune to consequences when they find they must pass as members of other priesthoods." "Made to feel strangely welcome, I'd say," added Jean. "And in the present circumstances, there are precious few practical disguises for a man of my size."
"Ah, I do see your point, Jean."
"It seems that the Death Goddess has been very busy of late," said Locke, "with a great many people other than ourselves. I'm quite awake now, Jean, and very comfortable, Master Rebellious. No need to get up. I'm quite positive my pulse is right where I left it, safe inside my wrist. What else can you tell me, Jean?" "The situation is tense and bloody, but I'd say Caparaza's carried it. Word's out that all of us are dead, except myself, with that pretty price on my head. Supposedly, we refused to swear allegiance to Raza, and tried to fight back on Barsavi's behalf, and were justly slain in the process. All the other Garistas are sworn. Raza didn't wait 3 days before he hit. The most recalcitrant got their throats slit tonight. 5 or 6 of them. Happened a few hours ago."
"Gods, where do you hear this from?"
"Some from Ibelius, who can get around a bit, provided he keeps his head down. Some from ministering. I happened to be in the wooden waste when a lot of people suddenly turned up needing death prayers."
"The right people are in Raza's pockets, then?"
"I'd say so. They're getting used to the situation. Everyone's like to pull knives at the drop of a pin or the bite of a mosquito. But he's got them coming round. He's operating out of the floating grave, same as Barsavi did. He's keeping most of his promises. It's hard to argue with stability."
"And what about our other concern?"
Locke made the hand gesture for Thorn of Camor. "Heard anything about that? Any, cracks in the facade?"
"No," whispered Jean. "Seems like Raza was content to kill us off as sneak thieves and leave us that way."
Locke sighed in relief. "But there's other strangeness afoot," said Jean. "Raza hauled in about 6 men and women last night, from different gangs and different districts, publicly named them as agents of the Spider."
"Really? You think they were? Or is it another damn scheme of some sort?"
"I think it's likely they were," said Jean. "I got the names from Ibelius, and I had a good long ponder, and there's just nothing linking them all. Nothing that signifies to me, anyway. So Raza spared their lives, but exiled them. Said they had a day to put their affairs in order and leave Camor for good."
"Interesting. I wish I knew what it meant."
"Maybe nothing, for once."
"That would certainly be pleasant."
"And a plague ship, Master Lamora," Ibelius spoke up eagerly. "A singular vessel. Jean has neglected to speak of it so far."
"Plague ship?" "A black-hulled vessel from Emberlane. A sleek little piece of business. Beautiful as all hell, and you know I barely know which part of a ship goes in the water." Jean scratched his stubble-shadowed chin before continuing. "It pulled into plague anchorage the very night that Kappa Raza gave Kappa Barsavi his own teeth lessons."
"That's a very interesting coincidence."
"Isn't it? The gods do love their omens. Supposedly there's 20 or 30 dead already, but here's the very odd part. Kappa Raza has assumed responsibility for the charitable provisioning."
"What?"
"Yes. His men escort the proceedings down to the docks. He's giving coin to the Order of Sendovani for bread and meat. They're filling in for the Order of Perelandro since, well, you know."
"Why the hell would his men escort food and water down to the docks?"
"I was curious about that myself," said Jean. "So last night I tried to poke around a bit, in my official priestly capacity, you see. It's not just food and water they're sending out."
4.
The softest rain was falling, little more than a warm, wet kiss from the sky, on the night of Thrones Day, the night following the ascension of Caparaza. An unusually stocky priest of Azaguia, with his wet robes fluttering in the breeze, stood staring out at the plague ship moored in Camor Bay. By the yellow glow of the ship's lamps, it seemed that the priest's mask glowed golden bronze. A decrepit little boat was bobbing in the gentle water beside the very longest dock that jutted out from the dregs. The boat, in turn, had a rope leading out to the plague ship. The Satisfaction, anchored out at the edge of bowshot, was looking strangely skeletal with its sails tightly furled. A few shadowy men could be seen here and there on the ship's deck. On the dock, a small team of burly stevedores was unloading the contents of a donkey cart into the little boat, under the watch of half a dozen cloaked men and women, obviously armed. No doubt the entire operation could be seen by looking-glass from any of the guard stations surrounding Old Harbour. While most of those stations were still manned, and would stay that way as long as the plague ship remained, not one of them would much care what was sent out to the ship, providing nothing at all was sent back. Jean, on the other hand, was very curious about Caparaza's sudden interest in the welfare of the poor seafarers from Emberlane.
"Look, best just turn right around and get your ass back.
Beg pardon, Your Holiness." Jean took a moment to savour the obvious disquiet on the faces of the men and women who turned at his approach. They seemed like tough lads and lasses, proper bruisers, seasoned in giving and taking pain. Yet the sight of his sorrowful visage made them look as guilty as children caught hovering too close to the honeycrock. He didn't recognize any of them. That meant they were almost certainly part of Raza's private gang. He tried to size them up with a glance, looking for anything incongruous or unusual that might shed light on their point of origin, but there was very little. They wore a great deal of jewelry, earrings mostly, 7 or 8 of them per ear in one young woman's case. That was a fashion more nautical than criminal, but it still might not mean anything.
"I merely came to pray," said Jean, "for the intercession of the Lady Most Kind with those unfortunates out there on the water. Pay me no heed, and do continue with your labours."
Jean encouraged them by putting his back mostly to the gang of labourers. He stood staring out at the ship, listening very carefully to the sounds of the work going on beside him. There were grunts of lifting and the tread of footfalls, the creaking of weathered, water-eaten boards. The donkey cart had looked to be full of little sacks, each about the size of a 1-gallon wineskin. For the most part, the crew handled them gingerly, but after a few minutes...
"God damn it, Muzzik!"
There was a strange clattering, clinking noise as one of the sacks hit the dock. The overseer of the labour gang immediately wrung his hands and looked over at Jean.
"Begging your pardon, Your Holiness, we promised we would, see these supplies safely to the plague ship."
Jean turned slowly and let the man have the full, drawn-out effect of his faceless regard. Then he nodded, ever so slightly.
"It is a penitent thing you do. Your master is most charitable to undertake the work that would ordinarily fall to the order of Perelandro." "Yeah, that really was too bad. Quite the, tragedy."
"The Lady Most Kind tends the mortal garden as she will," said Jean, "and plucks what blossoms she will. Don't be angry with your man. It's only natural to be discomforted in the presence of something so unusual."
"Oh, the plague ship," said the man. "Yeah, it, gives us all the creeps."
"I shall leave you to your work," said Jean. "Call for us at the house of Azaguia if the men aboard that ship should chance to need us."
Sure. Thank you, Your Holiness."
As Jean walked slowly along the dock, back toward shore, the crew finished loading the small boat, which was then unlashed from its mooring.
"Haul away!"
bellowed one of the men at the end of the dock. Slowly the rope tautened, and then as the little black silhouettes aboard the Satisfaction picked up the rhythm of their work, the boat began to draw across Old Harbour toward the frigate at good speed, leaving a wavering silver wake on the dark water. Jean strolled north to the dregs, using the dignified pace of a priest to give himself time to roll one question over and over in his mind. What could a ship full of dead and dying men reasonably do with bags of coins? 5.
Bags of coins? You're absolutely sure?
It was cold spending metal, Locke. You may recall we had a whole vault full of it until recently. I'd say we both have a pretty keen ear for the sound of coins on coins.
So unless the Duke started minting full crowns in bread since I fell ill, those provisions are as charitable as my god's damned mood.
I'll keep nosing about and see if I can turn anything else up.
Good, good. Now we need to haul me out of this bed and get me working on something.
Master Lamora, cried Ibelius, you are in no shape to be out of bed and moving around under your own volition. It is your own volition that has brought you to this enervated state.
Master Ibelius, with all due respect, now that I am conscious, if I have to crawl about the city on my hands and my knees to do something useful against Kappa Raza, I will. I start my war from here.
He heaved himself up off the sleeping pallet and tried to stand. Once again his head swam, his knees buckled, and he toppled to the ground.
From there, said Jean, looks damned uncomfortable.
Ibelius, said Locke, this is intolerable. I must be able to move about. I require my strength back.
My dear Master Lamora, said Ibelius, reaching down to help pick Locke up.
Jean took Locke's other side, and the two of them soon had him back atop the sleeping pallet.
You are learning that what you require and what your frame may endure can be two very different things. If only I could have a solon for every patient who came to me speaking as you do. Ibelius, I have smoked jeremite powders for 20 years, and now my throat bleeds. Make me well. Ibelius, I have been drunk and brawling all night, and now my eye has been cut out. Restore my vision, damn you! Why, let us not speak of solons, let us instead say a copper baron per such outburst. I could still retire to lashing a gentleman.
I can do precious little harm to Kappa Raza with my face planted in the dust of this hovel, said Locke, his temper flaring once again.
Then rest, sir, rest, snapped Ibelius, his own colour rising. Have the grace not to lash your tongue at me for failing to carry the power of the gods about in my fingertips. Rest and regain your strength. Tomorrow, when it is safe to move about, I shall bring you more food. A restored appetite will be a welcome sign. With food and rest, you may achieve an acceptable level of vigor in but a day or two. You cannot expect to skip lightly away from what you've endured. Have patience.
Locke sighed. Very well. I ache to be about the business of keeping Kappa Raza's reign short.
And I yearn to have you about it as well, Master Lamora.
Ibelius removed his optics and polished them against his tunic.
If I thought you could slay him now with little more strength in you than a half-drowned kitten, why, I'd put you in a basket and carry you to him myself. But that is not the case, and no poultice in my books of physic could make it so.
Listen to Master Ibelius, Locke, and quit sulking.
Jean gave him a pat on the shoulder. Look on this as a chance to exercise your mind. I'll gather what further information I can, and I'll be your strong arm. You give me a plan to trip that fucker up and send him to hell, for Carlo, Galdo, and Bug. 6.
By the next night, Locke had recovered enough of his strength to pace about the room under his own power. His muscles felt like jelly, and his limbs moved as though they were being controlled from a very great distance, the messages transmitted by heliograph, perhaps, before being translated into movements of joint and sinew. But he no longer fell on his face when he stood up, and he'd eaten an entire pound of roast sausages, along with half a loaf of bread slathered in honey, since Ibelius had brought the food in the late afternoon.
"Master Rebellius," said Locke, as the physicker counted off Locke's pulse for what Locke suspected must be the 13,000th time, "we are of a like size, you and I. Do you by chance have any coats in good care, with suitably matching breeches, vests, and gentlemen's trifles?"
"Ah," said Rebellius, "I did have such things after a fashion, but I fear Jean did not tell you."
"Rebellius is living with us here for the time being," said Jean, "around the corner in one of the villa's other rooms."
"My chambers, from which I conducted my business, well..."
Rebellius scowled, and it seemed to Locke that a very fine fog actually formed behind his optics.
"They were burned the morning after Raz's ascension. Those of us with blood ties to Barsavi's slain men, we have not been encouraged to remain in Camor. There have already been several murders. I can still come and go, if I'm careful, but I have lost most of my finer things, such as they were, and my patience, and my books. Yet another reason for me to earnestly desire that some harm should befall Raza."
"Damnation," said Locke. "Master Rebellius, might I beg just a few minutes alone with Jean? What we have to discuss is, well, it is of the utmost privacy, and for very good reason. You have my apologies."
"Hardly necessary, sir, hardly necessary."
Rebellius rose from his seat and brushed plaster dust from his waist jacket.
"I shall conceal myself outside until required. The night air will be invigorating for the actions of the capillaries. It will quite restore the full flush of my balanced humours."
When he had gone, Locke ran his fingers through his greasy hair and groaned. "Gods, I could do with a bath, but right now I'd take standing in the rain for half an hour. Jean, we need resources to take on Raza. The fucker took 45,000 crowns from us. Here we sit with 10. I need to kick the Don Salvara game back into life, but I'm deathly afraid it's in tatters, what with me being out of it for these past few days."
"I doubt it," said Jean. "I spent some coin the day before you woke up for a bit of stationery and some ink. I sent a note to the Salvaras by courier, from Grauman, stating that you'd be handling some very delicate business for a few days and might not be around."
"You did?" Locke stared at him like a man who'd gone to the gallows only to have a pardon and a sack of gold coins handed to him at the last minute. "You did? God bless your heart, Jean. I could kiss you, but you're as covered in muck as I am." Locke circled around the room furiously, or as close to furiously as he could manage, still jerking and stumbling as he was. Hiding in this damned hovel, suddenly torn away from the advantages he'd taken for granted for many years, no cellar, no vault full of coins, no wardrobe, no mask box, no gang. Raza had taken everything. Packed up with the coins from the vault had been a packet of papers and keys wrapped in oilcloth. Those papers were documents of accounts at Maraggio's counting house for Lucas Fairwhite, Evante Akari, and all the other false identities the gentleman bastards had planted over the years. There were hundreds of crowns in those accounts, but without the documents, they were beyond mortal reach. In that packet as well were the keys to the bowsprit suite at the Tumbleholme Inn, where extra clothing suitable to Lucas Fairwhite was neatly set out in a cedar-lined closet. Locked away behind a clockwork box that no lock-charmer with 10 times the skill Locke had ever possessed could tease open.
"Damn," said Locke, "we can't get to anything. We need money, and we can get that from the Salvaras, but I can't go to them like this. I need gentlemen's clothes, rose oil, trifles. Fairwhite has to look like Fairwhite, and I can't conjure him for 10 crowns.
Indeed, the clothes and accessories he'd worn when dressed as the Vardran merchant had easily come to 40 full crowns, not the sort of sum he could simply tease out of pockets on the street. Also, the few tailors that catered to appropriately rarefied tastes had shops like fortresses in the better parts of the city, where the yellow jackets prowled not in squads but in battalions.
"Son of a bitch," said Locke, "but I am displeased. It all comes down to clothes. Clothes, clothes, clothes. What a ridiculous thing to be restrained by!" You can have the 10 crowns for what it's worth. We can eat off the silver for a long time.
Well, said Locke, that's something. He heaved himself back down on the sleeping pallet and sat with his chin resting on both of his hands. His eyebrows and his mouth were turned down, in the same expression of aggrieved concentration Jean remembered from their years as boys. After a few minutes, Locke sighed and looked up at Jean.
If I'm fit to move, I suppose I'll take 7 or 8 crowns and go out on the town tomorrow, then.
On the town? You have a plan?
No, said Locke. Not even a speck of one. Not the damnedest idea.
He grinned weakly.
But don't all of my better schemes start like this? I'll find an opening somehow. And then, I suppose, I'll be rash.
Interlude. The White Iron Conjurers. It is said in Camor that the difference between honest and dishonest commerce is that when an honest man or woman of business ruins someone, they don't have the courtesy to cut their throat to finish the affair. This is, in some respects, a disservice to the traders, speculators, and moneylenders of Coin Kisser's Row, whose exertions over the centuries have helped to draw the Therin city-states, all of them, not merely Camor, up out of the ashes of the collapse of the Therin throne and into something resembling energetic prosperity for certain fortunate segments of the Therin population. The scale of operations on Coin Kisser's Row would set the minds of most small shopkeepers spinning. A merchant might move 2 stones on a counting board in Camor. Sealed documents are then dispatched to Lashain, where 4 galleons crewed by 300 souls take sail for the far northern port of Emberlane, their holds laden with goods that beggar description. Hundreds of merchant caravans are embarking and arriving across the continent on any given morning, on any given day, all of them underwritten and itemized by well-dressed men and women who weave webs of commerce across thousands of miles while sipping tea in the back rooms of counting houses. But there are also bandits, warned to be in places at certain times, to ensure that a caravan flying a certain merchant's colors will vanish between destinations. There are whispered conversations, recorded in no formal minutes, and money that changes hands with no formal entry in any ledger. There are assassins and black alchemy, and quiet arrangements made with gangs. There is usury and fraud and insider speculation. There are hundreds of financial practices so clever and so arcane that they do not yet have common names. Manipulations of coin and paper that would have bonds magi bowing at the waist in recognition of their devious subtlety. Trade is all of these things, and in Camor, when one speaks of business practices fair or foul, when one speaks of commerce on the grandest scale, one name leaps to mind above and before all others, the Maraggio. Giancana Maraggio is the 7th in his line. His family has owned and operated its counting house for nearly 2.5 centuries. But in a sense, the first name isn't important. It is always simply the Maraggio at Maraggio's. The Maraggio has become an office. The Maraggio family made its original fortune from the sudden death of the popular Duke Stravoli of Camor, who died of an ague while on a state visit to Talverar. Nicola Maraggio, trader captain of a relatively fast brig, outraced all other news of the Duke's death back to Camor, where she expended every last half copper at her command to purchase and control the city's full stock of black mourning crepe. When this was resold at extortionate prices so the state funeral could take place in proper dignity, she sank some of the profits into a small coffee house on the canal-side avenue that would eventually be called, thanks largely to her family, Coin Kisser's Row. As though it were an outward manifestation of the family's ambitions, the building has never remained one size for very long. It expands suddenly at irregular intervals, consuming nearby structures, adding lodges and stories and galleries, spreading its walls like a baby bird slowly pushing its unhatched rivals from the nest. The early Maraggios made their names as active traders and speculators. They were men and women who loudly proclaimed their ability to squeeze more profit from investors' funds than any of their rivals could. The third Maraggio of note, Ostavo Maraggio, famously sent out a gaily decorated boat each morning to throw 50 gold tarins into the deepest part of Camor Bay. He did this every day without fail for a complete year.
"I can do this and still have more fresh profit at the end of any given day than any one of my peers," he boasted.
The later Maragios shifted the family's emphasis from investing coin to hoarding, counting, guarding, and loaning it. They were among the first to recognize the stable fortunes that could be had by becoming facilitators of commerce rather than direct participants. And so the Maragio now sits at the heart of a centuries-old financial network that has effectively become the blood and sinews of the Therin city-states. His signature on a piece of parchment can carry as much weight as an army in the field or a squadron of warships on the seas. Not without reason, it is sometimes said that in Camor there are two dukes, Nicovante, the Duke of Glass, and Maragio, the Duke of White Iron.
Chapter 13. Orchids and Assassins. 1. Loch Lamora stood before the steps of Maragio's counting-house the next day, just as the huge Varari water clock inside the building's foyer chimed out the 10th hour of the morning. A sun shower was falling, gentle hot rain blown in beneath a sky that was mostly blue-white and clear. Traffic on the Via Camorazza was at a high ebb, with cargo barges and passenger boats dueling for water space with the sort of enthusiasm usually reserved for battlefield manoeuvres. One of Jean's crowns had been broken up to furnish Locke, who still wore his grey hair and a false beard, trimmed down now to a modest goatee, with acceptably clean clothing in the fashion of a courier or scribe. While he certainly didn't look like a man of funds, he was the very picture of a respectable employee. Maragio's counting-house was a four-story hybrid of 200 years' worth of architectural fads. It had columns, arched windows, facades of stone and lacquered wood alike, and external sitting galleries both decorative and functional. All these galleries were covered with silk awnings in the colours of Camor's coins, brownish copper, yellowish gold, silver grey, and milky white. There were 100 Lucas Fairwhites in sight even outside the place, 100 men of business in lavishly tailored coats. Any one of their ensembles was worth 5 years of pay to a common artisan or labourer. And if Locke set an unkind finger on so much as a coat sleeve, Maragio's house guards would boil out the doors like bees from a shaken hive. It would be a race between them and the several squads of city watchmen pacing this side of the canal. The winner would get the honour of knocking his brains out through his ears with their truncheons. 7 white crowns, 20 silver solons, and a few coppers jingled in Locke's coin purse. He was completely unarmed. He had only the vaguest idea of what he would do or say if his very tentative plan went awry.
"Crooked Warden," he whispered, "I'm going into this counting-house, and I'm going to come out with what I need. I'd like your aid, and if I don't get it, well, to hell with you. I'll come out with what I need anyway."
Head high, chin out, he began to mount the steps. 2.
"Private message for Coriander Previn," he told the guards on duty just inside the foyer as he ran a hand through his hair to sweep some of the water out of it. There were 3 of them, dressed in maroon velvet coats, black breeches, and black silk shirts. Their gold-gilded buttons gleamed, but the grips on the long fighting knives and clubs sheathed at their belts were worn from practice.
"Previn, Previn,"
muttered one of the guards as he consulted a leather-bound directory.
"Public Gallery 55. I don't see anything about him not receiving walk-ins. You know where you're going?"
"Been here before," said Locke.
"Right."
The guard set down the directory and picked up a slate, which served as a writing board for the parchment atop it. The guard then plucked a quill from an inkwell on a little table.
"Name and district?"
"Tevrin Callus," said Locke. "North corner."
"You write?"
"No, sir." "Just make your mark there, then."
The guard held out the slate while Locke scratched a big black X next to Tevrin Cullis. The guard's handwriting was better than his spelling.
"In with you, then," said the guard.
The main floor of Maraggio's counting house, the public gallery, was a field of desks and counters, 8 across and 8 deep. Each heavy desk had a merchant, a money changer, a law scribe, a clerk, or some other functionary seated behind it. The vast majority also had clients sitting before them, talking earnestly or waiting patiently or arguing heatedly. The men and women behind those desks rented them from Maraggio's. Some took them every working day of the week, while others could only afford to alternate days with partners. Sunlight poured down on the room through long, clear skylights. The gentle patter of rain could be heard mingled with the furious babble of business. On either side, 4 levels of brass-railed galleries rose up to the ceiling. Within the pleasantly darkened confines of these galleries, the more powerful, wealthy, and established business folk lounged. They were referred to as members of Maraggio's, though the Maraggio shared no actual power with them, but merely granted them a long list of privileges that set them above, both literally and figuratively, the men and women at work on the public floor. There were guards in every corner of the building, relaxed but vigilant. Dashing about here and there were waiters in black jackets, black breeches, and long maroon waist aprons. There was a large kitchen at the rear of Maraggio's, and a wine cellar that would have done any tavern proud. The affairs of the men and women at the counting house were often too pressing to waste time going out or sending out for food. Some of the private members lived at the place, for all intents and purposes, returning to their homes only to sleep and change clothes, and then only because Maraggio's closed its doors shortly after false light. Moving with calm self-assurance, Locke found his way to the public gallery desk marked 55. Coriander Previn was a law scribe who'd helped the Sanzas set up the perfectly legitimate accounts of Evante Ecari several years previously. Locke remembered him as having been a near match for his own size. He prayed to himself that the man hadn't developed a taste for rich food in the time since.
"Yes," said Previn, who thankfully remained as trim as ever. "How can I help you?"
Locke considered the man's loosely tailored, open-front coat. It was pine green with yellow-gold trimmings on the flaring purple cuffs. The man had a good eye for fashionable cuts, and was apparently as blind as a brass statue when it came to colours.
"Master Previn," said Locke, "my name is Tevrin Cullis, and I find myself possessed of a very singular problem, one that you may well be able to lay to rest, though I must warn you it is somewhat outside the purview